Sidney Poitier's Life Beyond Measure has captivated readers worldwide since its 2008 publication, becoming a treasured meditation on life's profound questions. Written as a series of heartfelt letters to his great-granddaughter Ayeli, the book has been praised by Oprah Winfrey as the most moving memoir I've ever read, and remains on Barack Obama's list of essential reads. What makes this work extraordinary is how Poitier transforms his remarkable journey, from premature infant, given little chance of survival, to groundbreaking Academy Award winner, into universal wisdom about courage, purpose, and human connection. The book's cultural significance extends beyond celebrity memoir, offering a bridge between generations and a testament to how one life, examined with honesty and grace, can illuminate the human experience for us all. When Sidney Poitier first held his two-day-old great-granddaughter Ayelle in an Atlanta hospital in December 2005, something profound stirred within him. At nearly 79, having already welcomed 6 daughters and 5 grandchildren into the world, this first of the next generation struck him with particular force. In that hospital room, surrounded by family, he witnessed 4 generations of women together: his ex-wife Juanita, his daughter Beverly, his granddaughter Aisha, and newborn Ayeli, each radiating her own essence while sharing inherited traits. The genetic thread connecting them was visible in their features, gestures, and expressions, creating a living tapestry of family history. Remarkably, Ayeli appeared to be the female version of himself as an infant, from the shape of her eyes to the curve of her nose. This powerful moment sparked the idea for these letters, a project that would become both a personal legacy and a bridge across generations. Poitier had been working on philosophical essays about life's unanswered questions, contemplating the nature of existence and human purpose, but seeing the stark contrast between them, she just beginning life, as he approached its end, shifted his focus entirely. He wanted her to know him through his own words and stories, not just sketches passed down through family lore. He yearned to share with her his experiences, philosophies, and connections to their human roots, stretching back tens of thousands of years, creating a personal history that would outlive him. The letters allowed him to revisit his past with new perspective, acknowledge how perilously he'd lived through segregation and poverty, and create a bridge across time between them. His intention wasn't to instruct Ayel, but to let her see him at vulnerable turning points, his struggles in New York as a young actor, his breakthrough roles, his fights against racism, and draw her own conclusions. Though their shared time might be brief, through these pages she could visit with him whenever she wished, learn who he truly was beyond his public persona, and understand life from his vantage point as he shared both vulnerable moments and victories that continued to humble and energize him well into his later years. His own survival story set the stage for everything that followed, a tale that seemed touched by destiny from the beginning. Born prematurely, weighing just 3 pounds in segregated Miami in 1927, doctors gave him little chance of living in an era when premature births often meant certain death, especially for African-American babies in the segregated South. While his father, Reginald, returned home to get a shoebox for his burial, his mother, Evelyn, steadfastly refused to accept this fate. In an act of desperate hope, she visited a soothsayer who made astonishing predictions that would shape the family's expectations. The child would not only survive but grow strong, travel the world, walk with kings, become rich and famous, and carry the Poitier name to global recognition. Against all odds, every prediction eventually came true, setting the stage for an extraordinary life that would transform not just his family's destiny, but the course of American cinema and civil rights. The world that shaped young Sidney Poitier was one of stark simplicity and profound connection to nature. On Cat Island in the Bahamas, his family lived as subsistence farmers, without electricity, running water, or telephones. This primitive yet nurturing environment fostered in him a sense of wonder and deep philosophical questioning that would remain throughout his life. Perhaps most striking about his early years was the complete absence of mirrors or photographs. Until age 10 and a half, he had never seen his own reflection clearly. "I'm the last witness to the details of my early years," he writes. "For my first 10 and a half years without mirrors or glass panes, I never saw my own reflection. This wasn't particularly troubling. I could see I had arms and legs like other children. One day, while playing alone by a pond, he discovered his shadow on the water's surface. This shadow mirrored his every movement, becoming his companion. They played together on beaches and danced without music whenever the sun shone. They were like Siamese twins with awful footwork, dancing only when no one was watching to avoid villagers thinking he was possessed by demons." By age 8 or 9, as his interest in the opposite sex grew, he became desperate to know what his face looked like. Despite his efforts, pond reflections were never clear enough, and they owned no mirrors in their thatched roof home. This all changed in 1937 when his family moved to Nassau. There, overwhelmed by his first encounters with cars, paved roads, and ice cream, he spotted a full-length mirror in a store. Standing before it at last, he examined every feature of his face with giddy excitement. His nose, eyes, cheeks, teeth, all bearing resemblances to his parents. 6 more years passed before he saw his first photograph of himself at age 16 in New York City, wearing the fashionable zoot suit of Harlem. "That photo shows little of the person I've come to know," he reflects. "Just my attempt to fit in and escape the loneliness of being constantly overlooked." Ironically, the camera that provided no record of his childhood would one day make his face recognizable worldwide. The Poitier family tree bore fascinating fruit on every branch, with each relative contributing to Sidney's understanding of human nature. His parents, Reggie and Evelyn Poitier, provided the foundation for his character and worldview. Though they had little formal education under the colonial system, they possessed remarkable wisdom that they passed to their children. His father, born in 1884, taught him that unlike eagles, humans must carefully prepare each generation to protect the next. His shy but loving mother maintained spiritual practices that retained remnants of their African heritage, despite the brutal erasure of their ancestors' culture through slavery. They were soulmates, lovers, friends, and dedicated parents who taught him to swim before he could walk by tossing him into the ocean. Among his siblings, each faced life's challenges differently. His brother Cedric, a dreamer fixated on reaching America, landed in jail for writing extortion letters, and later for attempting to stow away on a ship. Carl, a reclusive longshoreman, struggled with confrontation throughout his life. Cyril successfully stowed away to America, worked with his hands, gained citizenship, and proudly sent all 10 of his children to college. Reggie became a cab driver, raising successful children, and showing remarkable devotion by caring for his comatose wife for 5 years until her death. His sister Teddy held a special place in his heart, doting on him since infancy. When he was 12 in Nassau, a neighborhood bully knocked him unconscious during a confrontation. Teddy carried him home, revived him, then returned and thrashed the bully, warning him never to mess with her brother again. Her fierce protection and independent spirit made a lasting impression on him. Family relationships weren't always harmonious. When Sidney was nearly 8 on Cat Island, an inexplicable conflict erupted between his father and Uncle David, who owned a small grocery shop. One day, Uncle David suddenly attacked his father with stones while hurling threats and curses. His dignified father never threw a stone back, even as he was seriously injured. Years later in Nassau, when Sidney learned of Uncle David's death, he saw the deep sadness in his father's eyes that their rift could never be mended, a powerful lesson about the consequences of unresolved conflict. At 15, Sidney left Nassau for America, ill-prepared but carrying a core knowledge of himself that would sustain him through countless trials. His first night in New York after finding work as a dishwasher at the Turf Club and Bar earning $4 and change per night, he spent that night sleeping in a pay toilet at the bus station, spending a nickel for shelter. He wasn't successful managing his meager earnings, and ended up sleeping in bus stations and railroad terminals until he found a tiny room in Harlem for $5 a week. Even then, he struggled with the battle between want and need, with want winning far more often than it should have. When winter arrived with devastating cold, he wore all his summer clothes at once, with only a light jacket. Standing frozen on the elevated train platform at 125th Street, he vowed that someday he'd make it in this world. This led him to join the army before his 17th birthday, seeking shelter and regular meals. After 1 year and 11 days, he returned to Harlem, falling back into the same economic struggles. By accident, he discovered the American Negro Theater, and through persistence and luck, landed a role in Lysistrata on Broadway. Despite botching his lines on opening night due to stage fright, he received good reviews and caught the attention of producer John Wildberg, who cast him in Anna Lucasta at $75 a week. Even with this success, he often returned to dishwashing between acting jobs.
Two pivotal events changed his fortunes.
First, when the director at the American Negro Theater threw him out of his audition, bellowing that he should get a job as a dishwasher since he couldn't read or talk, he made a life-altering choice. Walking away, he realized the director had assumed dishwashing was his worth without him ever mentioning it. In that moment, he decided to become an actor, precisely to prove him wrong. The second pivotal moment came when a Jewish waiter noticed him struggling with a newspaper and offered to teach him to read. His kindness transformed Sidney's life, though Sidney regretted never properly thanking him after he moved to another job. Years later, even after his first movie and starting a family, He vowed never again to be washed away by those fierce economic waters between want and need. "I advise you, Aieli," he writes, "to learn the economic rules of the game, maintain your balance with self-reliance, and define your worth in your own terms, not by money's measure." Throughout his journey to success, Sidney battled various addictions that threatened to derail his progress. He smoked his first cigarette at 17 while in the army, trying to fit in with the older soldiers. Initially difficult, it soon became a two-pack-a-day addiction he couldn't kick. Drinking followed casual at first, easing his social tension as a shy guy in Harlem's social world, but gradually slipping into habit and then addiction. Gambling was his final acquired vice. Unknown in his youth on Cat Island, he developed an interest in cards, dice, and horse racing in New York City. Starting with pinochle among friends, he progressed to poker, blackjack, numbers games, and horse racing. By the time he was earning money as a young actor, he was already a veteran gambler. He was saved from serious trouble by Bumpy Johnson, a notable Harlem figure with underworld connections. After buying cleaning products from him for his restaurant Ribs in the Rough, Bumpy summoned him one day to warn him about the poker games he'd been losing. "I want you to stop playing poker. I know the people you've been playing with, and you can't win there," he told Sidney, directing him instead to the Rhythm Club, where games were clean and fair. As his responsibilities grew with marriage and children, he still gambled but cautiously, setting aside specific amounts based on his earnings. But one night in Nassau, after losing $10,000 in a poker game, he had an epiphany while crossing a bridge under a full moon. Looking toward Cat Island, where he grew up, he realized how many family members, college educations that money could have funded. He decided then to quit gambling forever. His smoking addiction worsened to 3 packs a day, until a frightening nosebleed in Nigeria while filming The Mark of the Hawk prompted him to quit. After 3 weeks without cigarettes, he foolishly tried just one in London to prove he had control, and immediately returned to his 3-pack habit. The addiction's grip became clear one night when, finding no cigarettes at home, he desperately searched through garbage for butts, then drove to the Bronx in the middle of the night to buy more. Drinking was his final demon to conquer. Though not an alcoholic, he noticed himself eagerly anticipating wine with dinner when dating Joanna Shimkus. Recognizing the early signs of addiction, he quit cold turkey 40 years ago. "We're all human and drawn to pleasures that give excitement or altered states," he reflects. But habits easily become addictions, often with just one first try. Crossing back might require a lifetime struggle. Throughout his life, Sidney faced numerous dangerous situations that could have ended tragically. In Miami at 15, he encountered a swarm of cops who forced him to walk 50 blocks back to the black neighborhood, threatening to shoot him. Despite his rage, he suppressed it, knowing that in 1940s Miami he could have ended up dead with little investigation. Later, the Klan came looking for him after he questioned a white woman's segregationist stance when delivering a package. Fortunately, he wasn't home when they arrived, and his family moved him to relatives in another neighborhood. His army discharge scheme nearly went catastrophically wrong. After working as a physiotherapist at Mason General Hospital, he feigned insanity by throwing a chair at the hospital head and later overturning a food-laden steam table. Weeks of psychiatric sessions and penitence followed before his discharge. Back in New York, he unwittingly emerged from the subway into a full-blown Harlem riot. Finding himself inside a looted grocery store with police entering, he fled to a storeroom where he played dead when officers searched with flashlights. After escaping, he discovered a bullet wound near his Achilles tendon, which he treated himself before returning to work days later. In Los Angeles during the mid-1950s, a speeding bus crashed into his car, hurling him and his passengers across a divider into a service station. Though knocked unconscious, they miraculously survived without serious injury. In Acapulco, he nearly drowned when caught in a powerful undercurrent, saved only when a lifeguard finally heard his screams after he'd been dragged under 4 times. Perhaps most dangerous was his 1950 experience filming in apartheid South Africa, where using a whites-only bathroom led to a confrontation. Later, his driver Dickie Nyaka, suspecting a plot against him, arranged an armed escort to the airport. When cars ambushed them on the highway, Dickie's skilled driving and their protective escort enabled their escape at 90 miles per hour. These experiences taught him about the thin line between bravery and cowardice. Cowardice paralyzes with the threat of devastating force damage to self-image, reputation, plans, or legacy, he writes. When cornered by threatening forces, cowardice whispers, "Make a deal for the least harm." Once you surrender to fear, you're damaged, though sometimes this allows survival to fight another day. Throughout his letters, Sydney urges Ayele to find heroes and role models from older generations who can inspire her through their character and courage. True courage, he explains, springs from within, requiring one to overcome fear despite potential bodily harm, death, or damage to reputation. This inner strength, he emphasizes, is what distinguishes genuine heroes from those who merely occupy positions of power. Nelson Mandela stands among his greatest heroes. Sydney nearly met him during a political picnic while filming Cry the Beloved Country in South Africa in 1950, a time when apartheid's grip was tightening. Years later, after Mandela's release from 27 years of imprisonment, he recognized Sydney at an event, calling Sydney and embracing him warmly. They developed a meaningful friendship through several meetings, maintaining correspondence despite Mandela's weakening health. Playing him in the 1997 film Mandela and de Klerk was both a profound challenge and honor for Sydney, who spent months studying Mandela's mannerisms, speech patterns, and philosophical outlook to capture his essence authentically. He also deeply admired Thurgood Marshall, whom he portrayed in film. During America's dangerous years of social unrest, Marshall risked his life entering hostile southern towns, sometimes sleeping in rooms, away from windows, or being transported in hearses to avoid detection by violent segregationists. His resolution to continue despite mortal danger exemplified extraordinary courage. Marshall argued 32 cases before the Supreme Court, winning 29, including the landmark Brown v. Board of Education case that dismantled legal segregation in schools. Jackie Robinson showed similar bravery, enduring deliberate pitches thrown at his head, constant death threats, and racial epithets while integrating baseball. They later became close friends, vacationing together in the Bahamas, where they would discuss strategies for advancing civil rights. Paul Robeson, an accomplished athlete, musician, and scholar fluent in 8 languages, fought tirelessly for disenfranchised Americans despite accusations of communist ties that eventually destroyed his career. His rendition of O L Man River became a powerful anthem of resistance. Lesser-known heroes included educator Revita Bowers, who transformed private education in Los Angeles, children's advocate Marion Wright Edelman, who founded the Children's Defense Fund, and political trailblazer Barbara Jordan, whose eloquent speech during Nixon's impeachment hearings captivated the nation. Earlier pioneers like Fannie Lou Hamer, who suffered permanent damage from a police beating in Mississippi, and Ida B. Wells, who documented lynchings despite death threats, faced incredible dangers fighting for civil rights. The Little Rock Nine, particularly Elizabeth Eckford, who faced an angry mob alone, and university integration pioneers like Charlene Hunter Galt, displayed extraordinary bravery facing violent opposition and daily harassment. President Lyndon Johnson deserved greater recognition for using all his political capital to pass civil rights legislation despite being a Southerner, knowing it would cost his party the South for generations. Similarly, Republican Chief Justice Earl Warren fought tremendous battles to achieve the unanimous 1954 school desegregation decision, working tirelessly to convince every justice to join the opinion. African independence leaders like Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana, Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya, and Julius Nyerere of Tanzania stood brave against colonial powers with overwhelming force, each developing unique approaches to nation building while facing both external pressures and internal challenges. In his final letters, Sydney acknowledges the fractured world he's leaving to Ayel's generation, one far more threatening to human survival than when he was young, with weapons that can destroy entire cities, ongoing wars, genocide, terrorism, street violence, financial uncertainty, greed, and lingering racism. Yet he remains hopeful, noting that despite similar slim odds against early human survival, no language, scientific knowledge, or protection from nature's forces, we endured. We evolved bartering systems, made geographical discoveries, developed stunning science and social structures. There's never been a perfect period for human existence, he observes. When I was born in 1927, life was meager for my family while much of the world suffered. The world today offers different opportunities than in his youth. When he was born, global population was just 2 billion, compared to today's nearly 8 billion, and death was frequent. On Cat Island, they had no modern medicine, not even aspirin-only remedies from forest plants. A black man then could expect to live only 40 years, yet he lived to 81, benefiting from medical advances, healthier lifestyles, luck, and geography. At 16, he saw no opportunities for himself until serendipity led him to that newspaper with Actors Wanted. He had no education or tools, just what he'd learned from listening to others. Curiosity became his friend, and he learned that survival rested with him. Through trial and error, he discovered how to manage on $15 a week. Ayela, at 15, will have tremendous advantages. 12 years of strong education, understanding of the world, mathematical knowledge, history, geography, and medicine. She'll be nearly independent, resourceful, conversant with communications and vast fields of information. He hopes she'll aspire to be at the table where big questions are addressed, understanding the world's strengths and frailties, questioning where power isn't used for humanity's benefit. In these letters, I leave an imprint of who I was, my values, beliefs, understandings and misunderstandings, times I was right or wrong, he writes. I leave you the music that played whenever I put my ear to the universe's mysteries. Life offers no guarantees, and will sometimes get lost and stand alone. But the tools for meeting life head-on are acquired knowledge, belief, and hope. Learn as much as you can, about as much as you can. The great disease of mankind is ignorance. With knowledge comes belief, that you can be better, that the world can be better. With that comes hope, the eternal tool in mankind's survival kit. We hope for luck, for a better tomorrow. We hope to somehow get out of this world alive. And if we can't and don't, then it is enough to rejoice in our short time here and to remember how much we loved the view.